Welcome to the Creative Circle Podcast, circle number 8, the show where we talk to all kinds of interesting people and find out about what they do, how they got to where they are, and all those other fun things with the world of production. And with me, as always, is co-host Aaron Evans.
Thanks, Phil. Today we're going to talk to some awesome guests, good friends of ours, Matt and Carol Weekman, about their video production business. Well, it's good to have you here, Matt. We've known each other for a little while.
Yep.
So do you want to explain, like, I don't know if I can explain what you do. I don't know if I totally understand what you do. So could you explain a little bit about what your world is about?
Well, before we get started with that, can I introduce my wife?
Yes.
This is Carol Weekman.
Hello.
We've been married for about a year, and we're running the business together.
That's super exciting. That's something I want to talk about because that's really interesting.
Yeah. So what do we do, Carol?
I make a lot of grilled cheese sandwiches.
That's, she does.
That's pretty much my biggest job description part.
And what else, Carol?
Well, we run a DJ service that does like 177 events last year, but over 150 weddings usually. Mostly a year, and Matt does quite a bit of video production as well. A lot of national shoots and a lot of regional commercial websites and product line.
Yeah, basically we're paid day in and day out to be communicators. So people hire us to come in and help them take either their concept or, you know, whatever it is that they're working on at that moment, and then kind of help make that a reality. And sometimes just having somebody else in the room that is a really good communicator, whether it be, you know, on the DJ side or even in video production stuff, having somebody that can communicate well, whether it be to lead the team or direct the shoot or produce the shoot, the communication part of it is really what we get hired to do the most often. You know, the technology is always out there, but it's having that person that's good at communicating, and that's where we, I guess, maybe have a lot of insight.
I think the biggest thing that we do is try to not work. We try to really enjoy what we do and not make it seem like a regular job.
Yeah, and it's not a regular job because you become kind of connected to who the clients are, and when you can do that, when the connection becomes something outside of the work, then all of a sudden the project takes on a personality of its own, and those are usually the most successful projects. So.
Mm-hmm. So how did you kind of get started in this? What took you down that road to do production?
Well, when I was in college, actually I'll go back to even high school. When I was in high school, I spent 4 years studying kind of speech type stuff, and I always kind of had a little bit of an interest in business. And by the time that I got to college, I spent all 4 years in and out of the studio, kind of hanging out, doing a lot of film production stuff and learning as much as I humanly possibly could about the technical side, because I've always been a strong communicator, but the technical side is usually the wedge that opens up the door, if that kind of makes sense. So when you have access to and you know the technology backwards and forwards, people find that out and they assume that you're a good communicator. But when you can come through and be a good communicator on the backside, then that's where it's really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm. When you got done with college, did you know what you wanted to do from there, where you wanted to go, or did that change?
Well, you know, I've always been a big fan of education, just with, you know, two parents that both do education as their full-time job. So I went on to actually get a master's from Savannah College of Art and Design. So I spent a year down there, and during that year that I was down there, I got on an airplane. Every single weekend I would fly across the United States to come back and essentially work as a communicator, a mobile DJ at people's weddings. And really having kind of 4 years of college to grow that business, and then keeping it going for the year that I was down in Savannah, Georgia, and flying back to the middle of the Midwest to come to a really small town and basically work wedding receptions every weekend, began to have that business kind of take on a life of its own and kind of grow the legs that it needed to get it to the point that, you know, kind of like where we are today, where Carol and I can both be doing this as our full-time job.
Mm-hmm. That has to be really difficult to be flying back and forth across the country every week, in addition to doing graduate level work and trying to get as much out of a program like that. Which program were you in at SCAD?
I was in the film and television program when I was there. Okay. And, you know, the biggest thing is this, is if you want something done, ask a busy person. And the more you think about that, the more you go, well, why is it like this? Well, mm-hmm. because busy people tend to, you know, be list oriented. When you're list oriented, you go, here's the laundry list of what I have to actually get done today. Mm-hmm. And you put it on the list and then you execute it, because unless you, it's a do or die type of situation. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, I'll be the first one to admit it was a ton of work flying back and forth, but it was that level of discipline when you apply it to your business that, that then you can begin to do it as a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Was there a particular system you used? I don't know if you like into any productivity systems or something, or like paper to-do lists or notebooks or however. Is there a way that you organized that specifically to keep it kind of under control, or was...
You know, I guess I've always been a paper and pen kind of guy, even though I'm, you know, Avid Symphony certified and, you know, I'm Final Cut, you know, guru. At the same time, you know, when you keep track of it and it has some of your own handwriting on it, I think it takes on a lot of personality. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of times when you can look back at a page of handwritten notes, and because it's slightly visual versus, you know, maybe just text on a page. Text on the page looks cleaner, and it's a good way of communicating between you and another person. But as far as you communicating with yourself, there's a lot to be said for being able just to have a page of handwritten notes. And maybe that's just a system that works for me. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes that I find some of the most creative or inspirational people still keep a journal for themselves. Well, they're not doing that typically on a computer. They're typically doing that, you know, with their handwritten notes. And again, mm-hmm. that's a system that works for me. That's not across the board. Mm-hmm. So what about you, Carol?
I think for Matt, the biggest thing is like having that calendar that he has. Like he's had the same calendar, Dayminder or something like that, for the last 8-10 years. Mm-hmm. And that's the only one that he will ever use, because he just really likes how that system is put together. And I, you know, that question, if there was ever a fire in your house, what was the one thing you would grab? I think for Matt, it would be that calendar, because it really does reflect.
About after you, you know, first I would grab you, and then I would attempt to grab the calendar.
But so. it is a really important piece to his organization.
Yeah, and there's a certain comfort level that goes along with like an actually hard written out calendar. At the same time that I say that, we are actually working on an additional system that's a text message based dispatch system that hopefully here in the next couple of months we'll begin to actually have a product that that may actually end up going and being sold at market. So,
So as you as we've talked so far, you've mentioned being a good communicator,
yes,
knowing the technology, and then having some sort of business knowledge or understanding as well. Of those three kind of
pillars
or areas, like, is there one that you would suggest somebody tackles first before the other two, or is this something you should try and do all at the same time, or what? Is there a hierarchy?
Yeah. I think it works like this. The technology, like I said before, opens up the door. So if you're in college and you're kind of thinking, you know, how do I approach this in general? You have to have a technical skill. Because when you have a technical skill, you're marketable to somebody that needs that specific, whether it be Photoshop or After Effects or learning Final Cut or learning Avid or, you know, whatever the program is. When you learn that, you know, programming language, you have a sellable skill. But like I always come back and say, is people don't remember, you know, what you say. They remember how you make them feel. So if you think about that, they don't remember the individual words that you use to get there. What they do is they remember how you make them feel. So the skill kind of opens up the door, and then the feeling is associated with, you know, who is this person, regardless of what the words are, you know, that you actually got there. It's spend that time learning to actually connect with them as a person, and then the rest of it falls out from there. Get your technical skill so that you have that. You have to have that. Unless you have that, the ball won't even ever start rolling. So. Mm-hmm.
So from graduate school, what did you do from then?
Graduate school, I basically got a job using this line. I'm not looking for a job. I'm looking to work for you. Mm-hmm. And that opened up the door to work at a film production company. Mm-hmm. And I spent 2 years of my life working 50 to 80 hours a week on film shoots, working in really, really different situations with everything from really, really big Fortune 500 type of companies all the way down to, you know, the guy that owns a pizza joint around the block. And again, only strengthen that communication part. But the whole time that that continued on, I basically kept working on my side business, which at that point was my DJ business.
Mm-hmm. How did you keep the DJ business up during that time? Was that, did you cut back on how much time you're spending on that? Or was it difficult to trying to be doing both of those things at the same time?
Yeah, and again, that's where it comes back to that communication part of it and understanding communication patterns. And there's a lot mm-hmm. to be said for that. You know, in advertising, they always talk about what's the buying order. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes when I pick up my phone, because I never know who's going to call. I mean, Polaris called this last week. I'm working on another big project for a company that produces docks and lifts. And we have about, I don't know, three or four other things that we're working on along with this little piece of software. Mm-hmm. And when you pick up the phone, if you spend that time communicating with them and asking questions, 9 times out of 10, the sale will happen when you don't sell towards it, that you ask questions towards it. And just starting with very simple things of, you know, how can I be helpful? Mm-hmm. You know, or what's on your mind today? Or if you were me, you know, how would you like me to respond to this? And put some of that responsibility back onto the client. And again, it works, you know, in my mind, twofold. It works onefold to alleviate some of the pressure from you. But the second thing is it gives the client the power. And the minute that the client feels like they have the power, mm-hmm. even though you're guiding the situation, when the client feels like they have the power, then it becomes their idea. They have ownership in it. And it's amazing mm-hmm. how you can guide meetings. I mean, just even yesterday, we sat and we met with, 10 people around in the room. And I knew that there was one other person that agreed with the point that I wanted to make. So instead of making the point and hitting it really, really hard, mm-hmm. I deferred to another person, which made them feel like $1 million in the room. I said, you know, I totally, totally get where you're coming from. But out of curiosity, I would like to hear what such and such has to say about this because I really value their opinion. Mm-hmm. So what happened in that moment? I gave the power to somebody else. They thought, this guy really values my opinion because I straight out said it. Mm-hmm. But because I guessed that she was going to agree with what I wanted to say, all of a sudden then she felt really good about herself. She hit the point really, really hard, and mm-hmm. I didn't have to do anything. Mm-hmm. So, and again, those type of things come from becoming really good at communicating instead of spending the time on the technical part. You have to know the technical part, but...
Right.
Any thoughts on any of that? No?
Okay. Is that group dynamic stuff something that you can learn in school, or is that something that's maybe more difficult to pick up? Because I guess that doesn't seem like something that people have a good grasp on in general.
Yeah, I mean, they don't.
I think a big part of it is when you're new to the industry, like I am, mm-hmm. you do a lot of listening. You do a lot of observing, and you see how other people communicate and how they like to be communicated mm-hmm. to. And that's going to help you, you know, be a better communicator the next mm-hmm. time you meet that person or the next time you're in that kind of situation again.
So it's really something you pick up through experience. And
partially, but, you know, there's definitely a couple of rules. And maybe Carol and I should just take a few minutes and kind of walk through some of those rules
sure.
and just see kind of how they go. The first thing that I always teach people is when you get into a meeting situation or you're sitting down with people for the first time, become the most comfortable person in the room. And do you want to kind of elaborate and talk about that? What does that mean?
Yeah, so like leaning back, not having like your arms crossed would be another helpful situation.
Yeah, and if you're standing, leaning up against something.
Yep, a smile on your face, open hands with your palms up instead mm-hmm. of down yeah. shows that you're open to the communication.
And just not putting things in front of you, you know, if you got a Pepsi or Coke and you set that up in front of you, again, you've put up a barrier between you and those other people. Or when you enter the room, mm-hmm. you know what I always tell people is take your jacket and unzip it. So mm-hmm. just pull it down and unzip it so that when you come into the building, again, that opens your body language up a little bit. And oftentimes, you know, the analogy that I've heard used before, and I still think it's brilliant, is, you know, imagine that you're a dog. What does a dog do? A dog lays down and they open up the palms, or they open up, you know, the inside so that you can rub their belly. Mm-hmm. And the same thing applies for humans, where when you come in, you open up your jacket, mm-hmm. or you sit down and you take your palms.
Although you don't usually rub your belly or their belly.
Not usually.
That's a bad group dynamic.
But that's
I wouldn't encourage it.
Yeah. But again, I think there's something to be said for that of that open body language and becoming the most comfortable person in the room. Mm-hmm. You know, fake it till you make it, like Carol always says. She always says, fake it till you make it. And what's weird is sometimes your body then tells your mind this is where you need to be. Another good example that we just used the other day, and we actually used it with a show we just produced called Dancing with the Mankato Stars. Mm-hmm. And I showed this to the lady that was doing some of the coaching with the actual talent there that day, is if you just take a deep breath in, hold it for a split second, and then you laugh from the top of that breath all the way through the very end of it. Mm-hmm. And you do that 5 or 6 times over, it very, very, very quickly changes that mental kind of mind frame that you're in. And I know for me, sometimes when I'm down and out, that moment before I have to get out of the car, mm-hmm. Just going through that simple routine is enough to kind of tip the scale in the other way. And all of a sudden, I become fun to communicate with. Hmm. So.
It's interesting.
it's a goofy little mm-hmm. trick, and again, you know, everyone that I've taught it to, mm-hmm. just try it next time you get out of your car. Deep breath in and just laugh it out till the very last, and by the time you do it the 4th or the 5th or the 6th time, mm-hmm. it's really weird how all of a sudden you start feeling better.
Interesting.
Another thing that Matt is really good at is whenever the phone rings, then no matter what he's doing, he mm-hmm. stands up, smiles, and then answers it. And having that second of break from what you're doing and that standing up mm-hmm. gives you a lot more energy when you're coming through on the phone to that new client or even current client.
Yeah, regardless of what it is, you stand up and, you know, even if you don't isolate yourself, you begin to have that energy, and by doing the physical shift, it causes your mind to do the mental shift. Hmm. So where a lot of other people will pick up the phone when they're sitting at the dinner table or sitting wherever, just take a split second, get your body to move a little bit, and it helps do that gear shift between those things. Mm-hmm. So,
cool. So, with your production business, that was something with video production. That was kind of something you had to start up as well to be this concurrent thing with the DJ business. Is that something that grew out of the DJing, or is that something that you started pursuing kind of separately from it after you left the company you were working for?
Yeah. You know, I always think that God kind of gives you two things. He gives you one thing that you oftentimes make money with, and oftentimes you'll have something else that you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And I know for at least both of my two parents, because I think you always learn the most from your parents. That's what it really was for my parents. There was one thing that they were passionate about, and then there was another thing that they made money with. And I think my passion's always been with the video production side of it because of the complexity. I mean, you can never beat video production. Mm-hmm. You know, you can never be truly the best graphic designer. You're always working towards something. And along with that comes a lot of fun, but also comes an enormous amount of frustration. Mm-hmm. Versus the DJ stuff, there is a lot of black and white, right and wrong answers to it. And at least for me personally, it's fun to have some of that creativity. Mm-hmm. And along with it goes a lot of frustration. But on the flip side of it, there's a lot of black and white answers on the other side of my business. So mm-hmm. a lot of times, just even depending on what mood that I'm in, will determine a little bit of what I work on for that day. So mm-hmm. thoughts? No?
What are some of the challenges of kind of starting your own business? Because something that we've talked about with people in the past, and Phil and I talk about fairly often, is the challenges of either going freelance or starting your own thing and all the investment that it takes. And you not only have to be really good at your technical job, whatever that is, like you were working for an employer, you also have to now be the salesperson and people find out, oh, I was going to be freelance and it's going to be so much fun to do my own thing, but I'm spending 60% of my time selling the thing that I want to do and only spending maybe 40% of my time actually making that graphic or shooting that video thing. Yeah. I guess could you talk a little bit about, maybe that wasn't a huge shift for you because it sounds like you were kind of already doing the sales part for so long with the DJ business. You seem like kind of a sales guy.
Yeah. And again, the sales guy, really, really good sales shouldn't ever feel like a sale.
Mm-hmm.
It should feel like something that you want to do. The minute that it begins to feel salesy, I usually say something about this isn't right. And you go back to figuring out how do you just communicate mm-hmm. more clearly. You know, the last couple of phases of sales should be fun. They shouldn't mm-hmm. feel like, well, now we're getting to that moment where we have to talk about money, and then you clench up.
Mm-hmm.
All of that should kind of be happening at the beginning of it where you're qualifying yourself. So when you actually get down to the money part, mm-hmm. you can just very openly and boldly say, you know, hey, I want to make $1,000 or $2,000 or $5,000 a day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at least for me personally, I very clearly can remember the day that our take-home pay was $10,000. You know, that first day that I made $10,000 in one day was mm-hmm. like, okay, there's something to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of these things that I've, because again, you fake it till you make it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get to a certain point and then it's like, okay, now this stuff is real. Mm-hmm. And for me, what it was, or what that line in the sand was that day where all the stuff that I had been preaching for forever
mm-hmm.
now had paid off and there was a financial reward. And I guess for me, that mm-hmm. bubble over point was that first $10,000 day. Mm-hmm. So
I think that part of it too has to come with like just feeling confident in the work that you have. Like not every client that comes in is a client that maybe, I mean, it seems like you always want every client that walks in the door, but mm-hmm. you really don't, because some of them, you're not going to be able to give them what they're looking for because they're not really sure of what they're looking for at that mm-hmm. point. And having confidence in what you're doing and then saying, you know, this is what it's going to cost for this amount of work that comes into it, you know, if they're not comfortable with that, then you have to still be comfortable with either backing down or standing your ground. And mm-hmm. I think that when you become really like grasping at straws or wavy in your communication, then they read that and say, mm-hmm. you know, this is not someone I want to work with. So having mm-hmm. that confidence that comes across with how you feel about your work and how you feel about, you know, that client, working for that client is important too.
And there's so many good ways of cheating that these days. And I'll just give you one quick example. But before you meet with anybody, you know, take and just key them into Facebook and hit add friend. So now all of a sudden they had this interaction with you during the regular work day or the business day. They go home and all of a sudden this person that they talked to added them as a friend.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very reassuring thing for them to go, wow, they want to actually be a part of my world. People that you want to be a part of, you know, mm-hmm. then all of a sudden there's this trade-off with them, mm-hmm. you know, kind of giving you their business. Another thing, too, that I want to talk about is the difference between being freelance and being an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're freelance, the way that we teach it and the way that it's taught is that you're being rewarded for a certain amount of hours that you spend working on something. So for every hour, I'm going to make $20 an hour, $100 an hour, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
So for each progressive hour, that's how you make money. Versus an entrepreneur gets paid on essentially building the system. And what happens is, as an entrepreneur, you put together this team of people, but when times are good, you know, that's great, and you can continue to work with your team of people, but the mm-hmm. minute that it changes, all of a sudden you go, instead of being an entrepreneur and figuring out how to make the widget better, how to build the system better, you make a mental change and you say, now I am the person that's actually working as the freelance, and you hire yourself because you're the least expensive. So some mm-hmm. of the best entrepreneurs that we know, what they do is they say, I'm an entrepreneur, I'm not going to take out the garbage. I'm not going to – and their list of what they don't do is actually way, way, way longer than mm-hmm. the people that are – and again, at the beginning, there's that bootstrapping stage. But the faster that you can make that decision as to what are the key things that you can affect. And for entrepreneurs, what happens is this really weird thing. Now, if we're just playing in the entrepreneur category, you work to a certain level, and then that level kind of defines you.
Okay.
All right. So I want to lay it out like this. Let's say, you know, you want to be a great cinematographer, right? And you mm-hmm. get known for shooting, let's just say, you know, film noir type of movies, right? Mm-hmm. So that genre begins to define you. And oftentimes, as soon as the rest of your community begins to essentially pigeonhole you into that type of work, mm-hmm. that's when you stop growing as a person. But you begin to take a lot of your identity from that. Mm-hmm. And as an entrepreneur, the minute that you can kind of break out of that allows you to, again, put new creative thoughts into your mind because you're not being pigeonholed by who you're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes in that second stage of entrepreneurial kind of thought patterns when you're 5 and 10 and 15 years into it, and again, that's where I am at that. I've been pigeonholed into this is specifically what you do. But if you mm-hmm. can do one or two projects that are outside of that, you bring a whole new level of knowledge to the things that you're already working on. So if you are mm-hmm. the film noir type of director, then all of a sudden you go and you do maybe just a small little project for your daughter, helping her put together, you know, 25 shots that's in a fun comedy about kids. And there's mm-hmm. something that you learn that adds just an enormous amount to what you already are very well known for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very scary thing because people know you for being good at that one type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of entrepreneurs, that's as high as they ever get, is the community then saying, this is what we value you for, but them saying, this is as far as I want to go, instead of making that leap of faith, which is, mm-hmm. I want to grow my own business by doing something that's outside of my comfort zone.
That's a lot to take in.
It's intense.
It is.
Oh, yeah. I keep going back to this with all of our guests, and I know that there's not any one-size-fits-all solution, but I'm really intrigued by the concept of experiences outside the industry which are beneficial to you. Like, I guess my example would be, like, I feel like, as like a rite of passage, everybody should like work at some sort of like retail gas station, something where they're dealing with people day in and day out, even if that's not what they want to do, just for the experience. And so, like, within the realm of production and communication, I mean, and business, is there something outside of that, trip wise or job wise or just experience wise that you feel was very, very valuable to what you're doing now that you maybe wouldn't have picked up on?
I think that every person that you meet is either a potential client, a current client. I mean, they're someone that you need to get to know. So when I go to the grocery store, every single person like that's like picking out a cereal and I'm picking out a cereal, like I talk to them and say, you know, how come you think that Cocoa Crisp is better than Mini Wheats? Like, am I wrong about this? Like, should I be trying Cookie Crisp this time? You know, and like, I might never buy that cereal because I don't like it, but it's good for me to know where they're coming from and to communicate with them. Or if there's a guy that's over by the flower department, you know, there's mm-hmm. a story there, and getting to know him and finding out like why he's getting flowers or who he's getting flowers for and helping him with that process is mm-hmm. something that helps me. I waitressed for forever, you know, like when I was going through college and high school, that was a big thing. And I know that it helped me in my communication skills. But I think that, you know, being a pizza delivery guy or working at a gas station would be a great thing. But there are so many people that you're constantly in contact with. You just have to take that step to communicate with them instead of look at your phone, text, or look away, which mm-hmm. a lot of the world does instead of talking to those people that are right there for mm-hmm. you.
And it's just amazing to kind of play off of that, how there's patterns. And if you can begin to pick up on those patterns, you can be great at marketing. And the patterns don't oftentimes start with doing marketing research. The patterns start with, you know, your brother-in-law coming over and spending a little bit of time with him, or kind of talking to people that are outside of your immediate circle. And I know, just to kind of go back to something that Phil said, with regards to the trips, there's never been a trip that I've been on that I didn't come back and have some little tip or trick or tidbit that somehow affected what I was doing in my you know, business. And just to use the example from before of getting to a point in your business where it's kind of the ceiling of complexity. When you hit that ceiling of complexity and you think, this is as many products as I can ship, or this is as much work as I can possibly handle, there's a certain level of complexity or a ceiling of complexity that you're hitting. When you, the minute that you're beginning to feel that, and for me, it's almost once a month that I feel like that. Go and take a couple of days and travel and do absolutely nothing that's related to, you know, what you're being paid to do. And your brain all of a sudden draws a new connection because you've exposed it to new things. But the issue right now is when you leave and go on vacation, you don't turn off your phone. So your brain never gets that, you know, in computer terms, you never get that hard reboot. Where all of a sudden, you know, you kind of get to clear everything away and begin to actually see it for what it is. And I think traveling does some of the best reconnecting, mm-hmm. at least for me personally.
No, I don't remember if it was Merlin Mann or David Allen or both, but they were talking about like the days right before you leave on vacation are like some of your most
productive days.
Productive days, and you feel the best and like. Yeah. I should take more trips.
For sure.
Take a weekly.
Or at least plan them, right?
Plan the trip, just don't go.
And again, why is that? It's because you're personally connected to what's going to happen. After you do something again and again and again, it's very repetitive. It becomes something that you're not, oftentimes you're not personally connected to because you've done it a million times. And so mm-hmm. all of a sudden there's a personal stake in getting ready for the trip, so you become very, very, very productive.
I think on that productive part that you were talking about too, Phil, is there's moments where you're like, this will take me 2 hours to do this. But then the next day or something like that, that project could take you 15 minutes. You just hit a surge. And you just really have to take advantage of those moments when you're feeling like, oh, I could take out my whole entire to-do list here. Mm-hmm. Then do that, even if there's other things that you want to do. Because when that slump happens, then go take that break or go to the grocery store and talk to someone.
Mm-hmm. Are there things you guys do to help get over those slumps, or like when that happens, or is there certain like rest and relaxation go-tos to get back in the zone?
Yeah, I think I'm a girl, so obviously shop therapy works wonders. But Matt does do massages. He'll do that. Or he has a massage chair downstairs. He'll take a nap in the day, go for a walk, go for a run. Exercising in the morning has been like just great for us because then we feel productive already at the beginning of the morning.
When you force yourself to get up and take, you know, a 3-mile run or just go and work out for a little bit or lift weights or whatever that is, all of a sudden you've started the day with something else that is for you personally. And oftentimes when you're an entrepreneur, there's so much that goes out. So the whole rest of your day you're spending pouring out your information or what you know about or reteaching or helping somebody with whatever their project is. And if you start off your day with a little bit of you right away at the beginning of it, it really does change kind of your general outlook for it. Because you kind of mm-hmm. Hey, I've gotten me in for the day. Now I can deal with everybody else. At least for me mm-hmm. personally.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to doing kind of freelance stuff and it kind of working for yourself and on your own, is that something you would suggest people, or especially like students, or people looking to do this, just jump out and do? Or would you suggest that maybe they go and work for somebody else first, or you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, with regards to how the freelance thing works, you got to decide, are you an entrepreneur or are you freelance? Because if you're an entrepreneur, you got to be putting together all the freelance people. Mm-hmm. And you got to be spending your time doing that. But almost everybody that I talk to is clueless if they're an entrepreneur or if they're freelance. Those two things are the same thing. And again, it takes years to figure that out if you're freelance or if you're an entrepreneur, because you hire yourself because you're the least expensive. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if you can make that decision that you are freelance, then just go do it. Because you have a skill. Spend your time learning about how to communicate clearly. Take an acting class. Take a speech class. take a communications course and spend your time, you know, doing that because you already have the skill if you're going to be freelance. If you're going to be an entrepreneur and that's really your focus, then spend the time, you know, reading books about how entrepreneurs, you know, think, and spending time listening to motivational speakers, and spending time doing things that help grow your business and not working on the one specific skill that your business does.
Do you have any entrepreneur people who you like to listen to or you want to plug? We can put them in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. Who is it? Seth? Is it Gorbin or Gobin?
Golden, I think Godin. That's how you say it.
Yeah, Matt listens to him all
he's
the time.
Fantastic.
Dave
he's...
Ramsey, we love. Yep. Who else do you listen to?
Tony Robbins.
Yeah.
I mean, basically those three. I spend a lot of time listening to Dave Ramsey. Dave Ramsey is wonderful as far as teaching you the emotional side of what money is and what money can do. And he always, you know, Dave Ramsey always talks about how, you know, there's really three things that you can do with money. You can, you know, save it, you can spend it on yourself, or you can give it away. And, you know, you get to a certain point and the giving it away actually creates as much of an emotional reward as almost anything else. And so there's, you know, tidbit after tidbit after tidbit that Dave Ramsey does a great job of kind of synthesizing some of those things and helping you to understand that as a creative professional, if you can take the money part of it and feel very comfortable with that, it gives you the freedom to say no to projects. And when you have the freedom to say no to projects, you can work on projects that are a lot bigger that play into the projects that you want to be doing as a person. And there's a lot of self-growth that's associated with that. But before you ever get to the point of saying, I don't think that's something that I want to do, you have to be very comfortable in the financial situation. And at least for you know, my wife and I, Dave Ramsey has been a good kind of guiding chart to be able to figure out how to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm. That is really nice to be able to say no to projects.
Yep.
I think that's been the most helpful thing for me, because there are people that are interviewing you to be, you know, the person that does the work for them. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea that we're interviewing them as well and saying, you know, we really don't fit the vision of this company. And that's a hard thing when it goes against maybe your morals or maybe just even your expertise on things, and to know when it's okay to say no.
Yeah. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, like Carol said, you're an entrepreneur. You have this natural tendency to want to say yes, but if you can deal with that element of the money part of it, and again, like Dave Ramsey teaches, you know, you work on your debts from smallest to largest. That's been a very, very helpful thing. You pick up momentum. And again, that momentum of the financial part of what's happening with you personally instantaneously transfers to the rest of your business. And you see that momentum in the way that you communicate with people. You see that momentum in the size of the projects that you're able to handle. And you see that momentum in the way that other people begin to relate to you. And that's really the fun part. So it starts on a very personal level. And again, because so much of the world and how we interact with everyone deals around this financial part, when you can have some amount of momentum working on your debts from smallest to largest, that momentum, like I said before, gets transferred to your business.
I think part of what we've been so blessed with is that we really do enjoy what we do. Mm-hmm. We enjoy who we work for, and we enjoy the work that we do for them. And having that as kind of our platform, or per se, so that we can say no to those, you know, certain projects, because you don't want to take a client and then dread going to work when that's something that you've loved to do as your passion or as the thing that makes you money. To hate your work, you're not going to do a good job in it. So,
How are we on time, Phil?
Oh, now I have to edit that out. We're good on time. We're about 40 minutes in.
Okay.
Do you have anything else you want to ask?
Is there anything that you're really excited about right now that you want to talk about, Matt? Any new things you're launching or something that you're really interested in right now?
Well,
it doesn't have to be related to anything else.
Yeah. A couple of projects that we're working on right now is a text message-based dispatch system. And the idea behind it is that the lowest common denominator is being able to text message back and forth. instead of email. You know, there's this general kind of thought pattern that when you email somebody, they'll email back. And I guess we found that to be true in some circumstances, but less and less true the more spam mail there is out there. And so where people are taking a day or two, you know, there kind of was this bottle curve to it where we started at the beginning, and the moment that you would send a message, then there was, you know, a 2 or 3 day wait that you could expect, and then you might get a message back via email. And then it kind of went to this really, really close gap where there was a year or two, at least in my mind, where you would email, and unless they responded within, you know, 12 hours, you're like, did they die? But now I feel like we're coming out of the other side of that, where it's kind of going back to this 2 and 3 and 4 day wait. And so the I guess the question to me is, what is the lowest common denominator? The lowest common denominator is the text messaging. You know, you text message somebody, it's amazing how often, even if it's the, you know, middle of the afternoon or the middle of the night, you get a message back from them right away. So building a whole system around communicating with somebody via text messaging has been a really exciting idea for us, and it's something that we're have a working kind of template up and racking for. And again, we're kind of honing that system. So that's something that I'm excited about. This last weekend, we had a chance to work for the American Red Cross, working on another big project. We earned $45,000 on this last Saturday for the American Red Cross, and we provided all the sound and the lighting, and mainly dealt with a lot of, with the communication part of that, and set up a bunch of equipment for them. So that's a huge check to the American Red Cross, and very unrelated to the text message-based dispatch system.
No, that's really cool.
But again, you know, when you spend some time traveling, your brain starts to put together these weird things, and you go, what if? And the general rule of thumb, like I've told you guys a million times before, is for every 10 or 20 of these things, and it's more likely 20, that you pick up and start working on, only one of them actually has a financial or an emotional big payoff. And so it means that as a good entrepreneur, you're working on multiple, multiple projects at any given time, and you got to keep the emotion out of it.
I guess, how do you deal with the fact that maybe a lot of those that you invest time in don't pay off financially? Do you just kind of figure that into your billing so that when something does pay off, then you're still making money those hours? Or how do you think about that?
You know, I don't really have a good rule of thumb other than to let the spirit of the law kind of guide me. And a lot of times if you live by the letter of the law, that would say for everything that you stuck time into, there needs to be a financial or emotional kind of, you know, reward with it, or even if it's spiritual. And what I've found is that by listening your way into the sales, it typically tells you where you need to be on that project. And so it's taken client by client, project by project on a very individual basis. But, you know, I mean, I've started hundreds of projects over the years, and I really only have, you know, 100 that have been wickedly successful. But those ones that are very successful, that's what everyone knows you for. And luckily it's like that. Luckily that's the way that the rule works. And it's weird because when you visit with me, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, he seems successful, or the business seems successful, or you know, the relationship seems successful. But on the flip side of it, I probably fail faster than anybody else that you'll ever meet. And most good entrepreneurs have a lot of that similar mentality, is whoever can fail the fastest. If you want to fail the fastest, work at a phone-a-thon. I always think that that's a good, you know, you're talking, going back to what Phil asked before about, you know, what are some of those bare bones basic things? Go door to door and try to sell something. You know, regardless of what business it is, within 6 months, you will have a whole new appreciation for understanding buying order and understanding how people communicate when you're forced to cold call somebody or walk up to their door and introduce themselves and be very, very present, you know, in that moment. And the more present that you can be, the more genuine you are. And that's a very hard thing in this very disconnected society where we hide behind an email and underneath the guise of a text message.
Yeah, I think that, okay, the guy that made the light bulb, right, they interviewed him and they said, you know, how do you feel about, well, this is a fake story, but how do you feel about have only, like, you're only known for one thing. You only invented one thing. And he goes, are you kidding me? I invented, like, a million ways to not make a light bulb. You know, and I think that every experience or every job that comes along, you know, that maybe doesn't pan out, you're at least learning from, or you're having experience in that market, so that when that next client comes along, you go, oh yeah, I've done this. I've been in this industry before, and I have knowledge to share with you then.
One of the marks of a truly successful person, and again, this is one of those really weird things that just only under tons of investigation do you really start to see this pattern or the trend. And the trend is you work really, really hard, and you fail a lot of different times. You find something that works. It mildly defines who you are as a person. The rest of the community jumps on board with it. You keep sticking with it. And then your job as an entrepreneur is you are the only person in your company or in the business that can break the system. And maybe you want to speak to this a little bit, Carol. What does it mean when we talk about, you know, I'm the only person that can break the system?
Well, I think for like our business, Matt gets a lot of time just to be creative. And I think Google is very good at this. They just hire really creative people and hope that those people will just come up with crazy ideas. Like, that's why they give them every Friday off or every other Friday off, just to have time to work on a project that they are really interested in, and then they can bring that to the table. And for Matt, his number one job is to just break the system, just to find a better way to do it or a different way to do it, and then use that to make our business better. So the more work that I can help him on in that regular day-to-day communication with clients allows him to just have time to break the system, to be creative. And I think that that's
it's very counterintuitive, because again, you know, going back to being in those initial phases of running and owning a business, you hire yourself because you're the least expensive to do all of the, you know, mundane tasks, whether it be shoveling the driveway or, you know, whatever that super simple thing is. And when you do that, you take yourself out of entrepreneur mode, because your effort and your energy and your mental thought process is going into something that maybe isn't helping to ultimately build the system.
So you're not saving money that way, really, in the end.
No, it ends up costing you a ton of money. Random thoughts with Matt Weekman.
That'll be next show. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I think those are some really great insights into a lot of different aspects of the business and the kind of the client side of things that we haven't covered before. So that was really good to hear thoughts about that.
Anytime.
Thank you guys for being on the show.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. Signing off. Over and out.
Well, Phil, where can we find show notes?
Show notes for this episode should be at creativecirclepodcast.com/8, as in the number.
Which comes before 9.
Which comes before 9, after 7. You can listen to 7, and episode 9 is not out yet.
Nope. But it might be out if you're listening after we record episode 9, so check if...
If you're listening to this in the future, which you probably are, you should definitely check it out.
If the Best Buy date has already passed, then...
Do not throw this podcast out.
Do not throw this podcast out.
Please enjoy by whichever date is more convenient.
It has very long shelf life. So, be sure to give us feedback if you love the show or if you hate the show.
Tell us how we can make it better.
It does help. We do read and respond to all of our feedback, so
every single piece. It takes 6 hours a week, but we do it. Tell your friends, especially if you like the show. Tell them. Hopefully they'll like the show too.
And send them a link. Tell them to subscribe on iTunes.
You can find us on iTunes. I think that's everything.
I think so. Until next time, Phil.
See ya.